supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In the opening chapter of Dr. Ross Green's book, The Explosive Child, Green describes 11-year-old Jennifer. She wakes up, makes her bed, and arrives in the kitchen to fix breakfast. There she finds a box of frozen waffles, takes out three for herself, and decides to save the rest for later. Just then, her brother Adam comes by and says he wants waffles too. Mom steps in to help Adam, and Jennifer loses it. In her mind, all the waffles are hers. She screams, she pushes. Her physical and verbal aggression is intense and frightening. Her mother and brother begin to cry. Well, we learn this is not the first time Jennifer has displayed this type of over-the-top behavior. She's a chronically inflexible, explosive child who consistently causes her family this enormous pain. Her well-meaning parents are overwhelmed and feel terrible that they've never been able to get a handle on her difficulties. This is a family that feels confused and isolated, but the truth is they are not alone. There are many Jennifers out there and variations on Jennifer, according to my guest, Dr. Ross Green. Green wrote The Explosive Child, now in its fourth edition. He's an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the originator of the collaborative problem-solving approach to handling difficult children. He consults with family, schools, and therapeutic facilities, and he lectures around the world. Ross Green, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So we're talking about the explosive child. We'd like to hear your story. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Do you have a child that you feel is explosive, has exhibited this kind of behavior, or even a child you've just had great difficulty trying to control, to manage their behavior? Again, 888-477-9499. I encourage you to call early in the show. I have a feeling our lines are going to be pretty filled up. Ross, this child you describe as inflexible and explosive, this is a very different child from the one who doesn't come to dinner when he's told or has trouble sharing. So what does their behavior look like?
Well, you know, there's a whole spectrum of things kids do when they're having difficulty meeting our demands. And, you know, that can range from what some people might think of as the so-called easy end of the spectrum, whining, pouting, sulking, crying, to things that become a little bit more objectionable to most adults, screaming, swearing, kicking, hitting, spitting, throwing, destroying, running, and then things can get even more extreme from there. I guess the important point for me is less what the kid is doing when they're upset, but more why and when they're doing it. I think we spend a lot of time and diagnose a lot of kids based on what it is that they're doing when they're looking bad, those specific behaviors. But I find why and when and what we ought to be doing about it instead of what we're doing now to be the most crucial questions to answer.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. So what we do as parents and mental health professionals is we look at the behavior, and these children get labeled angry or attention-seeking or defiant, even by their own parents. And, of course, other adults who watch these children behave, you know, they look at the parents as though they're not doing a good job. So what is going on?
You've you've just described the prototypical scenario, and the bad news is it tends to make things worse. You know, there's a lot of diagnoses that get thrown around for the types of behaviors that these kids exhibit, especially ADHD, in particular, oppositional defiant disorder. Sometimes, if it's bad enough, conduct disorder, depending on why they're doing these things in the first place. Sometimes obsessiveness or obsessive compulsive disorder. Sometimes things on the autism spectrum, like Asperger's disorder.
Bipolar disorders.
Oh, that's definitely on the list as well, and tends to refer to the more extreme end of the spectrum of things that these kids can do when things aren't going well. But the big question is, what's going on here? And here's my definition of when a challenging episode would occur. Challenging episodes occur when the demands being placed upon a kid outstrip that kid's capacity to respond adaptively. Now, if that sounds familiar...
Well, I need to be able to see what that looks like, Ross. So we'll get back to Jennifer and with the waffles. Now, her brother just wanted a waffle. That doesn't seem like a great demand to me.
It's not a great demand unless Jennifer is a very concrete, literal, black and white thinker who gets an idea in her head that it would take an earthquake to shake loose. So obviously we're not talking about an ordinary kid here, but one who's lacking some very important skills. In the case of Jennifer, the skill of gray thinking, but more generically, skills like flexibility and adaptability, frustration tolerance, problem solving. And just like any other set of skills, there are some kids who have those skills in greater quantity and are able to demonstrate them with greater efficiency than others. And Jennifer happens not to be one of them. So even when a seemingly benign demand, her brother wanting waffles, is presented upon the Jennifers of the world, these Jennifers lose it because they don't have the skills not to lose it. My mantra is, why are challenging kids challenging? Because they're lacking the skills not to be challenging. If they had the skills not to be challenging, they wouldn't be challenging, but it's those lagging skills that make what seem like ordinary, fairly benign requests from the environment seem insurmountable to this population of kids. And then, of course, they do something that we don't like very much, something on that spectrum that I described.
How come, Ross? Why do these kids lack those skills?
Well, good question. It hasn't been studied particularly well, especially in the case of behaviorally challenging kids, not as well as sometimes people pretend that it's been studied. But I tend to view challenging behavior as a form of developmental delay, just the same way we would view difficulty reading, difficulty writing, difficulty doing math as a developmental delay. We're just talking about a different set of skills here: flexibility, adaptability, frustration tolerance, problem solving. So I think that, the way I was trained, everything's 100% nature and 100% nurture, and good luck trying to figure out what the percentages on each thing are. I think that these kids are simply lacking some crucial thinking skills, but the science is not yet to the point that we can say with great precision why that is.
Well, let me take your language literally when you say a developmental delay. So then the question is, will it be outgrown?
I don't rely on kids outgrowing it, because in the same way that I wouldn't rely on a kid outgrowing difficulty reading, it's something that the kid's going to need our help with. It's not my experience that challenging behavior and the lagging skills that contribute to it get outgrown. These kids are going to need some specialized help from us, and here's the really bad news. What we often do to them in terms of intervention, I find, doesn't teach them the skills they're lacking, and in some instances, actually has the potential to make things worse.
You were talking about Jennifer and the Jennifers of the world being locked in on an idea and not being able to get rid of it, and being rigid about it. you know, my mind flashed to what goes on in Washington, and there's congrats. I'm wondering if those kids in Washington were defiant children. They certainly are now.
You know, it's a very good question. I would certainly say that, you know, when we start talking about how you help these kids, and that, of course, goes to the name of the model, collaborative problem solving, I think we'd all be much more optimistic about what's going on in Washington and our nation's ability to solve many of the difficult problems that we're facing if our politicians were not so entrenched in their polar positions and were a lot more willing and able to collaborate with each other so that problems finally got solved. I must say that my approach to challenging kids wouldn't differ a whole lot from my approach to helping the people who are responsible for solving our problems in this nation get the job done.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've already got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We've got Elizabeth on the line. Elizabeth, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My question kind of talks about what you just said. Will, my son is 10, and he absolutely has this personality. He has a developmental delay and some neurological problems as well. But the big question is always, is he going to be like this still when he's an adult? Like, we do therapy. He has therapy for past trauma in his life. And I don't know, I try to look ahead. I'm like, is one day, is he going to grow out of this? Because he even says it himself. What's wrong with my brain? Is this going to go away, Mommy? Am I going to be bad for forever? You know, and it's so sad, and I want to tell him something. But I feel like what you said, I don't know that he's really learning any skills to help him. You know what, we validate his feelings and mirror his feelings. We don't get mad at him, but what are these skills that he has to learn in order to not have this? I mean, I know he'll always have an intense personality, but the losing it over everything, he's so constantly overwhelmed. Like, will that ever go away, or will he need to be medicated until forever?
Well, I don't count on it going away, but I also don't view medication as necessarily the primary or only treatment option. We haven't really talked about collaborative problem solving yet, and I guess this is the point at which I should say not all therapies are the same. There are therapies that I think are oriented towards solving problems and teaching kids the skills that they're lacking, and there are other forms of therapy that have other goals in mind, not necessarily helping kids solve the problems that are reliably and predictably setting their challenging episodes in motion or teaching them the skills that they're lacking. The first step is to figure out what skills your son is lacking, and there's a form that would help you do that. Am I permitted to give the name of a website where people can find that form?
Only if you speak slowly.
It's the website of my nonprofit. The nonprofit is called Lives in the Balance, and the website is www.lives.org. And on that website, and there's nothing, you're not going to be charged for anything on the website, it's all free. There's a paperwork section of that website, and what you want to download and print out is a form called the Assessment of Lagging Skills and Unsolved Problems, or ALSIP. And that form contains two sections. One is a list of 20 or so odd skills that I find are frequently found lacking in challenging kids. And the second section is a list of potential, I call them unsolved problems, that may be setting in motion challenging episodes. This is step number one in getting on top of those challenging episodes. Step number one, first let's figure out what skills this kid is lacking so we are at the very least viewing him through the appropriate lenses, the lenses of lagging skills, rather than poor motivation, rather than poor discipline, rather than manipulative, attention-seeking, coercive, unmotivated, limit testing, all those phrases that are frequently thrown about with challenging kids that frequently lead us in the wrong direction. And then, in the second section, let's identify the specific situations in which challenging episodes are reliably and predictably occurring. I call those unsolved problems. And when those are identified, it becomes crystal clear what problems we need to solve so that two goals are accomplished. Number one, those unsolved problems don't cause challenging behavior anymore, because unsolved problems cause challenging behavior, but solved problems don't. And while we're busy solving problems, especially if we're doing it in a certain way, my way, collaboratively, a lot of the skills that your son is lacking would simultaneously be taught.
Elizabeth.
Yes.
I hope some of this is helpful for you. And Ross, if she goes to your website, will she be able to find local therapists who do this kind of work?
She will not be able to find local therapists listed just yet. I'm in the process of putting a great deal of energy into certifying therapists, but that's going to take a while. But what Elizabeth will find is a whole bunch of streaming video describing the collaborative problem-solving approach, showing what it looks like. There's a bunch of audio programming on the website that would help with some of the more nuanced or finer points of the model. It is literally a treasure trove of resources that take people beyond the explosive child, and I've been told really have been helping a lot of people implement the model.
Elizabeth, I hope that's helpful for you, and that's livesinthebalance.org. Okay?
Fantastic. I'm going to go there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Good luck, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Ross, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to break down what you said a bit, because what you said was great. It sounded a little bit theoretical, and I want to know what that looks like in real lives.
Let's do it.
And we'll do that. I also want to know about what the research shows about your model versus other models, if there is research. We're talking with Ross Green about explosive children. He's the author of The Explosive Child, now in its fourth printing. It's a highly regarded, well-respected book. He's the force behind the new nonprofit Lives in the Balance, which we just heard about. And he's also an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back in 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Parents, do you feel like you are losing your teenager to drugs and alcohol? If substance abuse is causing changes in your relationship with your child and you don't know where to go, the Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to individual sessions with a family specialist, which may help you regain control of your family. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IAmConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY. Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. Learn from professionals. Express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/HamiltonCommons or 215-351-0511.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with Ross Green. He's the author of The Explosive Child, which is now in its fourth printing, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about explosive children who are rigid, can be explosive, they're inflexible, and are lacking certain problem-solving skills, is what we're learning. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our lines are busy now, but please be patient, as one will open up fairly soon. Ross, before we get into collaborative problem-solving and what some of these problems are that kids can't solve, what's it like to be one of these kids on the inside?
They are puzzled because they themselves don't exactly understand why they're having the difficulties they're having. They're frustrated because they see themselves having difficulties that often other kids don't have, don't understand why, but are often on the receiving end of the worst that adults can offer up, timeouts, groundings, punishment, sometimes physical, detention, suspension, expulsion, if this is at school. And they're at a complete loss for why this is happening to them. And the bad news is that sometimes, if this goes on for long enough, they actually become rather alienated, start hanging out with other kids who have become alienated, and start heading down a path that we very much wish they wouldn't head down. They often see the world as being unfair because they're really having difficulty making sense out of why they're getting punished so much for things that they don't understand and feel like they're having difficulty controlling.
Do they experience themselves as defective or wrong? We heard Elizabeth's child say that her little boy said, "Will I always be bad?" Is that common for these children to experience themselves as bad or wrong or defective, or do they just feel that the world is unjust?
I think that it can break in either direction, but I think that the vast majority of these kids, certainly not all of them, but the vast majority of them, certainly have the sense, as would many kids who are having other forms of learning disabilities. A kid who's having difficulty reading is cognizant of the fact that the rest of the class seems to be reading better than he or she is, and wonders why. A kid who is exhibiting challenging behavior is cognizant of the fact that the other kids around them, sometimes siblings, often classmates, are not having as much difficulty with behavior as they are not getting in trouble anywhere nearly as much as they are. So these are things that are hard to notice. I don't usually hear the word defective come out of one of these kids' mouths,
sure,
but I certainly hear them saying, pondering, what's the matter with me?
Hmm. And same question about parents.
We live in a society that still views challenging kids, behaviorally challenging kids, as the byproduct of poor discipline at home. And I believe that that is a completely misguided belief system. I think it leads us to completely counterproductive interventions. But we still live in a society that views parents as defective for the fact that they have kids whose behavior is not under complete control. And what a shame that is, because as hard as it is to handle one of these kids at home, as much guilt as these parents feel, as much as they question their own parenting abilities, the last thing we'd want to do to add to their burden is have the rest of us judging them from afar. As I've always said, unless you've walked in the shoes of one of these parents, it's very hard to imagine what it's like to live in a household with a challenging kid who's not responding to the discipline, the supposedly good discipline, that most of us supposedly responded to.
Reward and punishment doesn't work with these kids.
You know, there are data to say that in some of these kids it does work. One of the problems with those data is that rewarding and punishing, as many parents and teachers have experienced firsthand, may work for a period of time, but then sometimes those improvements don't stand the test of time. And in my opinion, that's because, well, I think that in most of us you'll see a burst of improvement in response to heightened incentives. But reward and punishments in general don't teach these kids the skills that they're lacking. And rewarding and punishing kids for doing what we want them to doesn't help us figure out why they're having difficulty doing what we want them to in the first place, and doesn't solve those problems in the second place.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ellen on the line. Hi, Ellen. Ellen?
Hello?
Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a 6-year-old son who has been in and out of psychiatric inpatient hospitals most of the summer. He's been diagnosed with ADHD and mood disorder, but everything you've described this morning is him. And I thought so, but I don't understand why they don't diagnose him with explosive disorder. Because that the waffle thing, that goes on every day at our house.
Hmm. Well, now, Ellen, in the same way that ADHD and mood disorder are often too vague to really help us understand what lagging skills are setting the stage for your son's episodes. Explosive disorder wouldn't really move the process further a whole lot either. So I'm going to encourage you to do the same thing that I encouraged our first caller to do, and that is get on that Lives in the Balance website, download from the paperwork section the assessment of lagging skills and unsolved problems, and let's get to know your son through the prism of lagging skills and unsolved problems. That's information no diagnosis will give us. And then let's see if we can start solving problems with your son so that the unsolved problem setting in motion his explosions don't set those explosions in motion anymore.
How do we do that? How does Ellen do that? What's her first step? What's her next step?
The first step is the ALSA. The second step is to start solving problems. And I need a few minutes to describe that. There are three ways in which adults might be solving problems with kids. One is extremely popular, but actually sets the stage for challenging episodes. That's called Plan A. Plan A is what I call unilateral problem solving. It's when a parent is imposing their will, or teacher, is imposing their will on a kid.
Let me stop you there.
Go ahead.
Ellen, does this sound familiar?
Yes.
Okay. All right. That's
not surprising. Whenever I'm listening to parents tell me about challenging episodes, one of the things that is almost always present in those stories is Plan A. Mm-hmm. Plan C is when you're just dropping an expectation or an unsolved problem completely, because most challenging kids have a big old pile of unsolved problems that has accumulated over time. And we're not going to be able to solve them all at once. We're going to work on two or three of them at a time, and the rest we're going to table for now just to clear the smoke and make sure that Ellen, you and your son are available for the hard work of solving the problems that remain.
What kind of problems do you mean? Like what?
What kind of things go into Plan C? Things many parents are having trouble giving up on. And it's not, we're not saying that you got to give up on them forever. It's just that we got to stabilize things in a lot of families of very challenging kids. And so, just as an example, teeth brushing often ends up in Plan C. So let me give you just an example of what Plan A would sound like on teeth brushing. Billy, it's time for you to go brush your teeth. That's actually not Plan A. Billy, no. Parent, if you don't go brush your teeth right now, you're going to get a timeout. If this is an explosive kid, kaboom.
Right.
Here's Plan C. Billy, I'm not going to ask you to go brush your teeth right now because that's not one we're working on right now. That's Plan C. But the biggest project in most of the families and schools of very challenging kids is to help them move from Plan A, imposition of adult will, unilateral problem solving as the means of solving problems with challenging kids, to Plan B.
All right, we're with bated breath here.
Plan B is when you're solving the problem collaboratively, not unilaterally, and it consists of three basic ingredients, all of which are very well described, not only in the book, but also on the Lives in the Balance website. The first step or ingredient is called the empathy step. This is where we are getting the kid's concerner perspective on the table on one of the unsolved problems that we wanted to be talking with him about right now.
For example.
And of course, what's the best timing on this? The best timing on this is not as everybody's already heated up. The timing on this is proactive.
Give us an example of
okay.
A problem.
Billy, I've noticed that you haven't been doing much homework lately. What's up? Now, this is where collaborative problem solving starts to become interesting, because what we're looking for here is information. And some kids are able to provide that information, and some kids a little bit less easily. But what we're looking for is any information Billy can give us about why he's been completing less homework lately.
You have to take a position that the issue now is not about control and about managing behavior or even changing anything. You have to take a position now that you need connection and information.
That's exactly right.
That's a big shift for
it's
parents.
A huge shift, because you're in the problem-solving business now, not the discipline business. the problem-solving business.
Okay.
As I mentioned, it's only unsolved problems that set in motion challenging behavior. And Plan A, imposition of adult will, doesn't solve problems durably. And in the case
right.
of very challenging kids, often sets in motion their most challenging episodes.
All right. So now we're back to Plan... Ellen, you still there with us? You didn't fall asleep or anything? Okay.
The second step is called the define the problem step. This is where the adult is getting their concern or perspective entered into consideration on the same unsolved problem. Now, it's that concern that has historically frequently been leading the adult into Plan A, but now that concern or perspective is going to be entered into consideration and addressed with Plan B. We now have two concerns on the table, the kids and the adults, on the same unsolved problem. Time for the third ingredient. It's called the invitation. This is where adult and kid are brainstorming solutions so as to come up with one, and this is the hard part, that's both realistic, meaning both parties can do what they're actually agreeing to do, and mutually satisfactory, meaning that the concerns of both parties have been addressed.
So let me stop you there for a minute, Ross. Ellen?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's this been like for you, listening to Ross?
Enlightening in the fact that, you know, some of the things we've been able to start ourselves. My son has three goals. One is not to hurt himself, not to hurt others, and not to hurt property. We talk about this a lot, and it opens the door for discussions in Plan B. You know, what would you do if, how can you, you know, handle this anger better, you know, situations like that. So it helps to reinforce what we've started to do with him.
Hmm. Sounds great. I would strongly recommend you check out Ross's webpage, livesinthebalance.org, and I highly recommend his book. It's an important book, and it's very well written.
I will. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Ellen, good luck.
That was wonderful. That was really helpful, Ross. Let's take another call before we have to go to break again. We've got Becky on the line. Hi, Becky.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to let you know that my son recently, just a couple months ago, was, I guess, diagnosed with the explosive disorder. And we were given your book by our family therapist, and it has literally changed our lives. You know, for the last couple of years, you know, you do the best as you can as a parent, and there is this one piece missing of not knowing what tools, and there's no reward ever worked, and just, you know, the violent reaction that he would have, and the complete having no control. I just really feel empowered now and most grateful for this book. And the hardest thing that we have is, like you said, people with perceptions of how a child should act and how a parent should parent. So it's difficult, you know, trying to coach him in soccer or baseball or, you know, in any kind of social situation. And also to relearn or reeducate ourselves as parents on how to parent this very special, brilliant child.
Well, Becky, you know, you may have noticed I was have been giving Ross kind of a hard time to be more concrete. So I've got to do the same with you. So
okay.
Tell us your son, daughter?
Son, yes.
How old is he?
He's 7, and he's recently, you know, we knew he had ADHD, and he was recently diagnosed with Asperger's as well. And then, of course, we have this very explosive component that was, like,
well,
Ross was saying, was never, you know, hard to pinpoint.
Well, tell us what collaborative problem solving looks like at home.
Well, we're in the beginning stages of it, so a lot of it is, you know, my husband and I trying to remember to use Plan be. You know, it's kind of like, because your initial reaction is to be like, no, you can't do that, or no, this is the way it's going to happen, you know, and not take any guff from the child, or, you know, if you're on a schedule, kind of, if you get rigid and the child's rigid too, it's all over, all bets are off. So last night it was bedtime, and my son decided that it was his turn. He didn't have a turn to play in the family room, and he was going to the basement. And I was like, no, you have to, it's bedtime. It's time to go to bed. Well, you know, I just created a tremendous nightmare, and it took me an hour to calm him down. And, you know, he wanted to move all the furniture out of his room and rip every, you know, he can't have any kind of decorations or anything on the walls in his room because he will rip everything down. He's, you know, we're considering putting bars or some sort of safety apparatus on his second floor windows in case he just gets so angry he just wants to. On Friday, he packed a bag to run away from home because he didn't get his way. So it's just, you know, here's a seven-year-old who is just filled with rage and can't express it. And, you know, to really try and backtrack and know where I, as a parent, need to be so much more aware of what I'm doing, it's really, the onus is on the parent. And it's an incredible amount of energy to parent one of these children and to just rethink and relearn everything.
That is a fundamental truth that is very difficult for parents to live with, that the fact is these kids are high maintenance and will be for a while, and that doesn't make the kids wrong, it doesn't make the parents wrong, it's a fact of life, and that's very difficult for parents to live with.
It's definitely been bittersweet, I would suppose, because, like I said, these tools have been really wonderful as far as having an answer to this other missing component besides the other two issues that he has. You know, he's got we've got a lot of work cut out for Harley, but, you know, at the same time, just knowing that this is our life.
Yeah.
But that's why, you know, and that's okay, though, because we're put on this earth to mentor and shepherd our children and take care of them the best that we can. And, you know, because of, you know, the fabulous team of specialists and therapists we've been able to put together, and by the grace of God and the referral to Dr. Oni Dakari, who referred us to Dr. Green's book, but, you know, it's literally been life-changing.
Well, I'm glad, and you said an important word that I know Ross is addressed in the book, and that's a sense of empowerment, because parents feel out of control with these kids. And, you know, to have any vehicle that helps you feel more empowered really is, that alone is life-altering. Well, like I said, we've got to take a short break. We've been talking with Ross Green, who's the author of The Explosive Child. Now, in its fourth printing, he began a nonprofit called Lives in the Balance. They're really a great website. Look them up, livesinthebalance.org. And our number is 888-477-9499. When we come back, I want to talk with Ross about anger in these kids and anger management, and do these emotions have to find a better way to find their voice. We'll do that right after a 60-second break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to making lives better every day. They've developed a partnership with the University of Pennsylvania for Cancer Treatment, Radiology, and Radiation Oncology. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKX crossover, featuring sync with My Lincoln Touch in-car connectivity system for voice commands. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
It's 1246, 86 degrees in Center City.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about explosive children with Ross Green. He's the author of The Explosive Child, and he's created a wonderful new nonprofit called Lives in the Balance, and you can find them at livesinthebalance.org. Ross, I labeled the issue of anger before our break, and we've been hearing a great deal of anger with these kids. Now, we know that anger comes out of frustration because they can't solve a problem or they're overstimulated. But the form the anger takes is also a problem. And is there room for a child to find a voice for their anger?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm perhaps overly precise about words, but I don't tend to describe these kids as angry or rageful. I know some do. I tend to go with frustrated. And I think that the goal is to help these kids learn how to deal with their frustration more adaptively. And to help them do that, I find that we need to help them solve the problems that they're having difficulty solving that they're so frustrated about. But one of the reasons they're so frustrated is because adults have been trying to solve those problems through unilateral problem solving or imposition of adult will. I find that when adults start solving problems collaboratively with kids, they don't look angry anymore, and they don't look rageful anymore, and they don't even look all that frustrated anymore, because now there is this mechanism in place for these kids to have their concerns heard and a process through which they're confident, once it's taken hold, that their concerns will not only be heard, they will be addressed.
Well, let me press something here. These kids, I mean, we're not going to be able to help them solve all their problems, and they're going to be facing some frustration, and they might not have the tools. So is there value in teaching them ways of dealing with their frustration, anger?
Well, when we think, I think we should probably give some thought to how most of us who think we're pretty good at it do it. How does one, say, an adult who's highly skilled at dealing with frustration, deal with their frustration? First, they identify what the problem is that's making them frustrated in the first place. And then they do something that we encourage two-year-olds to do, but that many very challenging kids have difficulty doing. We encourage them to use their words. And then what we encourage them to do is solve those problems so that they're not frustrated about them anymore. I think that's how adults who deal with frustration well deal with frustration well. It's the exact same approach with kids who are having difficulty dealing with frustration well. It's the exact same process. The important piece is that if adults are so wrapped up in being strong and powerful and not being wimpy and not being passive or permissive, then they never permit that process of collaborative problem solving to unfold, and the kid never learns the skills.
Well, you asked about how adults deal with frustration. I mean, I like to think that I say I'm frustrated when I am or angry. Sometimes I'm not even aware of it until after I realize that the person I'm talking to, I've got fantasies of putting my little hands around their neck. And then I realize I'm having emotions that I was heretofore unaware of. So, you know, I don't think I'm the only person that feels that way. So, you know, sometimes we have to deal with our emotions once they're getting pretty big. So how do we teach kids that? How do we help them find words to identify these emotions?
Well, and it depends on what words we want them to use. There's certainly a place for teaching kids to label their emotions. I can't say that that's what I spend most of my time doing. I'm more intent on teaching them the words that they need to tell other people what's getting in their way,
right,
what they're concerned about, what's troubling them. I'm interested in teaching them the skills to listen to somebody else's concerns. And I'm interested in teaching them the skills to work toward solving problems with people in a way that works for both parties. As you mentioned earlier, our current situation in Washington, there's just an utter lack, apparently. You know, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors or with eyes being winked, but there's an apparent total lack these days of a collaborative process in which those ingredients are being applied.
Are you saying that our elected officials need parents?
Saying what?
We need a parent to come down there and straighten it out?
Depends on what kind of a parent it is. we don't need a Plan A parent because they all seem pretty good at that already.
Yeah.
And it's just that more Plan A begets more Plan A.
Yeah.
That's sort of what's going on here. There's an enormous amount of one-upsmanship and posturing going on. Not a great deal of sharing concerns. A ton of jumping to solutions before we actually know what the concerns of both parties are. Very hard to solve a problem
and
collaboratively.
And my fear is that voters are resorting to Plan C. I want to talk about the word collaborative, and it's more than just parents and children, and that's the part that fascinates me. Let's bring on Nicole, who I think is going to address this issue. Nicole, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, what can we do for you?
Well, actually, my son has been diagnosed since the age of 3. I thank you guys for taking the time to actually do this program. I appreciate it. He's been diagnosed since 3, and I've been dealing with administrators since the moment he started kindergarten. And I want to know, what do I do to educate the teachers, the people who are working with him every day, the people who aren't trained to understand what explosive behavior is, or Asperger's, or ADHD? They just see a bad kid.
Yeah, let me add to Nicole's question to you, Ross. Not only are they not trained, but they've got less and less time and more pressure to achieve certain outcomes. So what can you say to Nicole?
Well, the simple answer on educating people in education settings, which is one of the things I probably spend most of my time doing these days, but I will say I find that most educators are eager to know more about challenging kids and how they can help them better. But I think, Dan, your point, which is that there's more pressure being placed on educators these days than ever before to kind of be robots in the teaching of curriculum. And, of course, the kids in our schools who suffer the most when teachers are forced to be completely consumed by curriculum is the ones with social, emotional, and behavioral challenges who are disrupting the classroom process. And it's very easy to just, quite frankly, get rid of them. But the quick answer is another book. The Explosive Child has been read by many educators, but many of them said to me, could you write one that is more specific to our setting? And the book is called Lost at School. And a lot of the information on the Lives in the Balance website is actually pretty much oriented toward educators. And so those are some of the resources that are available to educators for learning more about this. I guess the key point is, I don't want to demonize, not that we were demonizing anybody, but I don't want to demonize educators. I find that they are working under extremely difficult circumstances, and I find that most, some listeners may find this hard to believe, but this is my experience, most have the best of intentions and would love to help a kid with behavioral challenges if they only had the tools to do it.
So one of the things I hear you saying, or maybe I'm reading into this, is that, Nicole, it might behoove you to read this information and to you to establish a collaborative relationship with the administrators, maybe be able to summarize it with them or give them a book or recommend this book to them and figure out with the administrators how the two of you can best help your child. So I hope that was helpful. It sounds like we don't have her on the line, but I do hope it was helpful. So one of the things you recommend is to expand it. We do have to include educators in collaborative problem solving. Yes,
oh my goodness, yes. There are so many things. There are good things that are going on in schools these days with behaviorally challenging kids, but there are also still a lot of things going on that are completely counterproductive. Corporal punishment, massive rates of suspension, detention, expulsion, discipline referrals in our schools, and they don't teach our behaviorally challenging kids the skills that they need,
well,
and they don't solve the problems that are getting in their way.
Well, they reinforce it because you know, zero tolerance policies mean we don't have any tolerance either.
Well, and the data on zero tolerance seem to be in and suggest that it actually made things worse.
Sure, sure. Let me ask you, we've got just about a minute left. Where were these kids 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Was it happening more now?
It certainly seems that way. People who were paying attention to these things 20 years ago certainly tell me that there seem to be more of these kids, but that's a little bit hard to gauge. I think they've always been around. I remember when I was in elementary school, these were the kids, and these were the kids we were losing back then, too. I hate to see kids get lost, especially when we have the tools to do it differently.
Yeah, I didn't see them when I was in elementary school, but that was in the beginning of public education. But, I mean, I saw kids who were quiet and withdrawn. I didn't see this wild behavior that I'm seeing so often now. I guess I'm asking a question that really doesn't have an answer yet. You know,
it's a tough question to answer because we don't have great. The best data that we have are pegged to diagnoses, and I'm not sure those are the data we want to use.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have to tell you on a personal and professional level, Ross, I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. It is so important. And, you know, your work began four editions ago, thinking out of the box. And I hope the box has caught up with you by now and that it's more and more mainstream. It's just great work. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Ross Green's an associate clinical professor, Department of Psychiatry at Harvard. And he's the originator of the collaborative parent-solving approach. He's the author of The Explosive Child. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll be talking about the new monogamy. Tune in. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. And you can listen to archived editions at our website, whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Sherry Siegel is our intern and helped out with the phones today. And I am Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.